My career has been very squiggly, so all over the place. And yeah, I mentioned that I was an optician, but I'll go back a little bit earlier than that. So I didn't finish high school and I didn't go to uni, which was very unexpected of me at the time. But I was a bit of a rebel. And I ran away from home when I was 16.
Hello and welcome to the Brand My Career podcast. I'm your host, Alex Cutford, and I'm so glad you're joining me today. My goal is to help you take ownership of your career, find your people through personal branding and networking, and take career-enhancing action. Managing your life and career can be hard. That's why every fortnight I'll be releasing an episode where I interview a diverse range of guests that will help you find clarity and build confidence in your career. Let's get into it.
So welcome back to another episode of Brand My Career. And I'm lucky enough to have Rebecca joining me today. Rebecca, could we start the interview with you just introducing yourself and sharing a bit about what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Rebecca de Blasi, but you can call me Bex if you want. I'm a career coach. But my background, I've been doing that for about 3 years, and my background before that was in HR and recruitment. But my very first job was as an optician, but we'll get into that later, I'm sure.
I definitely want to hear and understand what that is.
So I have a business called Design Your Best Work Life, and I work with clients generally mid-career. A lot of women, particularly parents, returning to work or figuring out their next step once their kids are a bit bigger, and helping them to achieve their career goals.
Yeah, awesome. And so I often like to hear how people have sort of come to the place that they're in their career. So what did you say that first job was?
My career has been very squiggly, so all over the place. And I mentioned that I was an optician, but I'll go back a little bit earlier than that. So I didn't finish high school and I didn't go to uni, which was very unexpected of me at the time. But I was a bit of a rebel and I ran away from home when I was 16. But it all worked out. So I was working as a checkout chick in New Zealand. And also in a bookshop there part-time. And then I took a casual Sunday job at an optician, so at OPSM in New Zealand. So I was just doing that on Sundays. And then that kind of evolved into a full-time role. And then on the job, I did some study, so I became a dispensing optician. And then suddenly I had the opportunity to actually manage a branch of my own. And I was only 18, almost 19 at the time. So that was just like a baptism of fire, learning how to manage people who pretty much most of them were the same age or older than me. But I loved it. I learned so much.
It is always a challenge when you are trying to lead people either. Well, leading people in general is a hard thing. But when they feel like they're either your equals or someone that has got, you know, decades more experience than you, that's always an interesting dynamic.
It is. And I started managing a much smaller branch, and then I ended up going back to manage the branch that I'd been trained in because my wonderful manager had retired. And I mean, she taught me everything that I needed to know at the time. And I remember there was a guy there, his name was Kevin, he was 60. And he was like the expert in all things kind of optics and glasses and lenses. And I had to go back and manage him, and he'd like trained me, and it just... Yeah, it was really a big challenge. But I think, you know, there's that when you become a manager, a people manager, I think it take, you know, one of those key lessons that you learn is that kind of line between wanting to be people's friend and then needing to be a manager and more of a coach. And that can be a tricky lesson to learn, I think, for anyone stepping into a people management role. So I learned it really, really early, which was good.
How did you go winning over the 60-year-old? Did he get on board with your leadership?
Oh, he was lovely. Yeah. He was so lovely. And I think because he'd trained me and because we'd built that relationship early on, the conversations that we had were really open and transparent and kind of not weird. And I think he also understood what he needed to do, and he was a fabulous employee. So there was very little that I had to do in terms of actually managing him. And he supported me a lot to then help me to manage a lot of the other employees. So he made it really easy for me.
But you make an interesting point, because you maybe didn't feel like you had to manage him, but obviously you just mentioned there you build a relationship with him, which is a pretty good starting point if you want to if you want to lead people. So, and so what were some of the ways that you sort of established that relationship, like going in to allow that to sort of flourish in a quite a natural and comfortable way in the end?
Yeah, so I think I've always been someone who's quite vulnerable, like openly vulnerable, and who, like, I've never been afraid to kind of, you know, share what I think challenges are and what I think problems are, and to kind of get people's buy-in on that. And so I think that was part of it, but also just kind of really understanding that everybody's motivations were different. So, say, in the example of Kevin, his motivation was that he just loved the work that he did. You know, he was very technical, and he also loved kind of helping customers and providing that real technical advice. So being able to give him as much opportunity as he needed to do that and really play to his strengths. And then some of the younger people in the store who maybe were casual or just, you know, working part-time, their motivators were very different. You know, this was maybe something that they were doing to support their studies, or it was just a bit of a money earner so that they could go and have fun, or they were saving for a holiday. So kind of building that relationship to understand that, and then I guess offering them opportunities to just do what they liked doing to achieve what they wanted, and kind of motivating them in the way that they wanted to be motivated. I think that was definitely a big lesson that I learned.
That's awesome. It was actually, when I sort of stepped into a management role sort of maybe about 2 years ago now, and I'm sort of going in, I was sort of, you know, I've sort of progressed up, and then sort of going from having people that were my colleagues to then managing them, and I was thinking, all right, this could go either which way. And I essentially, like on one of my first sort of meetings, basically read to them, I sort of wrote it down, what are my strengths, what are my weaknesses, and read it to the group. And because it had sort of been, there was a bit of tension of the way that I'd gotten the role and stuff. So sort of like, I want to try and make sure people don't feel like I'm this, you know, the young arrogant guy coming in thinking I know it all. And so some of my team were distant, some were in the room. So I'm sort of doing it. I'm like, I don't know how this is going down. It's sort of, the people on the screen are sort of like, oh, they just like talking and laughing about this. Like, how's this going? And then I went out and visited one of my workers in another town, and we sit down and to catch up, and she looks at me and goes, that took balls what you did the other day. And she's like, and yeah, really sort of had her respect from that moment. And so that was really good. So yeah, I think vulnerability is really key, a really key part of leadership and management.
Yeah. And my manager in that role before I had left, so the one that retired, Kath, I think one of the biggest things that she told me, like right from the beginning, was her job as a manager or as a leader was to train me as a leader. You know, that was her job. Her only job was to ensure that she was training other leaders within the business. And, you know, she taught me that when I first joined. So I think I was 17 at the time. And that stuck with me, you know, that is such an important part of leadership, and that it's not about you. It's about you adding value to those people that you're working with, and helping them to become leaders or to become whatever they want to be. And I think when you can transition into that mode, it kind of takes some of that fear or kind of judgment, fear of, you know, judge people judging your leadership style, when it's like, well, no, I'm just here to help you. I'm here to add value.
So you mentioned you left home at 16. So I left home at 16 as well. Now, I'll need to clarify like what you mean by running away, because for me it sort of more so felt like mum was pushing me out in a positive sense. I was getting ready to decide to move down to Canberra from Bathurst, and Thought I was going to be an AFL star and was joining an AFL team down there and stuff. And thankfully got an apprenticeship as well while I did it, because I definitely worked out as a better tradie than football player. But I remember having some second doubts about, I was like, oh, maybe I should stay one more year and stay play one more year of footy here before I go down. And Mum was like, no, just go now.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, left at end of year 10 and went down there and did my apprenticeship. So how do you feel that journey for you has sort of shaped your career journey?
It's a bit of a different story, but I was pretty good at school, and that kind of became sort of the focus, you know, and I think it was just at that particular time, I think, you know, that generation where that being good academically was kind of held up as the highest possible thing that you could achieve. And, you know, I went to quite a small all-girls school in New Zealand, and there wasn't as many options to maybe pursue the kind of things that you wanted to do. So it was like either you're good at maths or you're good at English or you're good at science or whatever. And, you know, the subject choices were limited. And like, I really wanted to do things like theatre sports and debating. And, you know, I was the house captain, you know, and I was terrible at sport, but I loved cheering people on and, you know, all of those things. But I just didn't, the options weren't there. And I think it wasn't necessarily supported as like a pathway. And so I just kind of lost my mojo at school, you know, like I went from straight A's to just really not being interested and then being a bit kind of rebellious.
Yeah.
And wanting to do things my way, and feeling a bit confined as a, you know, 15, 16 year old girl. And so at 16, I literally climbed out my window and left.
Wow.
And I'd said, been threatening my parents for a while and saying, well, if you don't let me do what I want to do, I'm going to leave when I turn 16, because that's the point at which it's legal to leave. And they just thought it was all talk, but I'm one of those kind of people that can be a bit stubborn, and yeah. I just did it and went and stayed with a friend and just never went back.
Wow.
Yeah, I ended up going, so I was at a all girls kind of semi-private school. I still wanted to go to school. Like, there was this real conflict in me of still wanting to be good, you know, and go to school and do the things that I'm meant to do, but also kind of go out into the world and be someone that I wanted to be that was maybe a bit different from what was expected.
Yeah.
So I enrolled in the public high school and I did maybe 6 months of that. But then I just enjoyed earning money too much. And, you know, I had the opportunity to be more of a checkout chick and more of a bookshop kind of earner. And then it kind of ended up working at OPSM. And it kind of, I think the thing for me, like, I don't remember ever having any careers education. I truly don't. Like, I don't remember any conversation with a careers counselor or anyone in the school. I think what happened is it really kind of happened vocationally in a way. Like, I, you know, just landed into these opportunities, realized what I was good at, and then kind of kept doing them and just taking the next option that presented itself. And I had really good people around me encouraging me and, you know, kind of advocating for me as well, like the managers that I mentioned. So I was a bit crazy for a couple of years, but I came back online at 18 and, you know, been pretty good since then.
That's pretty wild. That definitely could have gone many different directions.
Could have gone a very different way. And I think a lot of people that maybe I spent some time with at that point in my life did go a different way. I think I just wanted to break out of the box that maybe people wanted to put me in.
Yeah, it's I think that's definitely a really big thing, is these big systems that we have around education. And, you know, school is meant to be all about preparing people for what comes next. It's not meant to be a thing in and of itself, though. As things evolve over time, it sort of starts to, it does become a thing in and of itself. And it's like, oh, I left school and went into work. And it's like, oh, that's the goal anyway. So it's kind of this, why wait around if you're ready to get into it, you know? So,
And then, and I think also I didn't have any idea what I wanted to do. And I think, I always remember my dad had been quite good at sort of giving me a bit of financial education, and there was just part of me that was like, I can't bring myself to go and rack up thousands of dollars of debt on something that I just don't know what that should be. And so there just wasn't enough comfort in me to do that. And so I just ruled out uni for, you know, that as an option. Whereas maybe if I'd had some more guidance at the time, that would have helped. But I was just like, no, I want to go and earn money. I can figure that out later.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm starting to consider uni degrees now that I've worked as a tradesman, and then I sort of moved into youth work. And then I sort of moved into career development and things like that. So, and then it was annoying my wife, because I was looking into, I was like, oh, maybe I could do a master's. And my wife goes, no, you have to do a bachelor's. I was like, no, with all my prior learning, I'd be able to do it through my prior learning of, you know, the work and stuff I've done. She goes, what? She goes, oh man, she's got the uni debt. She's got the big uni debt and stuff. And so that's, it's funny.
I think later in life study is amazing. Like I did it. So, you know, three years ago now, I did my grad cert in careers education and development.
Yeah.
And I was able to dedicate myself to it in a way that I know that I wouldn't have done when I was 18 or 19 or however old. And I remember, you know, even throughout all my HR career, it used to be one of those kind of party trick things that you could mention that, like, no, guys, I didn't go to uni and I don't have an HR degree. And people would be like, oh, really? But that's one of the prerequisites that we had. I'm like, well, you know, I learned on the job. I didn't need to. Yeah. And I think we're getting better at understanding that that doesn't need to be a prerequisite. But
The lifelong learning piece, I think, is starting to be valued a bit more. And I think just people skills, human skills, soft skills, which I think people are sort of thinking through the language of that now, because they're realizing actually it's not too soft. It's actually really vital. All of that stuff is becoming more and more valued by employers, because there's so many things that are getting automated and don't require human function just to do the mundane, you know, repetitive things. They need people that know how to work with people and problem solve and have empathy and all of this stuff. So,
And that, I mean, that, like what you said, that who've actually worked with people and had that experience, I think that was the catalyst. It was like the seed for my kind of getting into HR, was that when I was in that management role at OPSM, I had to do a lot of performance management. And, you know, there were a couple of tricky situations that I had to manage that kind of ended up in people leaving the business. And I worked a lot with HR to kind of make that happen. And then because I'd done it and done it well and in a compassionate, you know, way, I then was asked to do it, to move stores, to kind of make that happen at another store. And I then was able to use that. So to kind of finish off that story, I ended up, you know, I'm a Kiwi. I wanted to do my OE or overseas experience. So when I was 21, I moved to the UK along with everybody else. And, you know, I was working at an optician there, but it was just a whole different experience. You know, like I'd come from an environment where it's, you know, very customer service oriented, and you say, how are you? And then when I was in the UK, I'd have people walk into the opticians. I'm like, hi, how are you? And they would be like, oh, are you trying to sell me something? And then, you know, I would put people off. It was just really, crazy. And
classic British.
Yeah. And I had to learn how to be all right instead of my hello. But I'd made friends with someone, and she worked in a cafe, and it was her birthday. And so we did a lock-in at the cafe. So they closed the cafe and we basically just had a party in there. And the, you know, complete happenstance, but the cafe owner's wife was an HR manager and she needed an HR assistant. And I, very drunk, was telling her how much I didn't like the job that I was in. And she mentioned she needed an HR assistant, and I kind of told her, I was like, oh, well, you know, I've worked alongside HR doing all this performance management stuff. And she was like, right, come for an interview. So I did a couple of days later, and I got the job. And that was, you know, complete happenstance, but, you know, the opportunity just came up, and then I was able to take all of those learnings that I'd had actually doing the doing and then take that into a role where I was kind of advising and coaching others on how to do it. So that was kind of how that all started.
Yeah, it's a funny thing when I think about so career development and coaching people, and it's also like getting the message across, like there isn't this like perfect roadmap. Like you just gotta just get out there, do the thing, follow the thing you're interested in, you're passionate about, that you're good at, whatever it is, and stay open, stay curious, and things will just literally come from the most random places. But because you were sort of engaged and thinking about it, and you had different plans and ideas floating in your head, like all of a sudden you take that opportunity rather than someone says, oh, I've got this, and you go, oh yeah, you, but then it shoots on by and you just keep staying in the job that you hate because you weren't ready to really comprehend jumping at something like that.
I felt really validated when I did my graduate certificate and learned about theories like planned happenstance and chaos theory, which the whole core of that theory is that careers are squiggly, you know, they don't need to be linear, which was I think what we learned at school, you know. It was like, okay, pick your career. Are you going to be a lawyer, a doctor, or a teacher? You know, that's what it felt like at the time. And, you know, you start at the bottom and you work your way up. And, you know, that wasn't what I had done. And throughout my career, that wasn't what I had done. And then when I learned about planned happenstance and about being open to opportunities, looking around, seeing them, being curious, trying things out, kind of creating opportunities to be lucky. And that is a very solid career management approach. I felt really validated. I was like, I have been doing the right thing. Whereas for a long time I thought, no, I didn't do it traditionally. So in some ways that was the wrong thing. And it was just a real light bulb moment. And I've been able to then help others have that light bulb moment who've come and said, I've done this, and I just, you know, I don't think that's of any value and employees aren't going to see that of value. I'm like, no, this is absolutely a good way to do things. And then they've been able to have that light bulb moment. So, yeah, it was very validating.
Yeah, that's awesome. You've probably just put language that I didn't have to some of my thoughts around planned happenstance. That's really good. I'm going to go Google that later. But it's something that I've written, and I've on my website, I have a thing, the 10 career building principles. And one of them was going, what came first, the growth mindset or the opportunity? Because the growth mindset often prepares you to be ready for the opportunity, and the opportunity you take because of the growth mindset. And it's this sort of funny little self-feeding cycle. When you're sort of developing yourself, you're ready for an opportunity when it comes, so you consider that a viable opportunity. If you're sitting stagnant, opportunities are coming all the time, but you just never think that or are ready to jump at them.
Totally agree. And now that I have, so I've got a 6-year-old and a 3-year-old, and now that I've got a kid at primary school, you know, you start to hear a lot about growth mindset and how it's a fundamental part of the curriculum, is trying to give children a growth mindset. And it kind of touches on what you just said, that it's like, well, if we can give them every, you know, opportunities, if we can tap into their curiosity and the things they're interested in and give them some space and opportunities to kind of just explore that a little bit further and then to explore the next thing. You know, and it's a little bit like an early childhood setting, the kind of interest-led learning, then that in itself will help to build that growth mindset as well, like you said, rather than it being sort of, okay, we're going to teach you to have a growth mindset, you know, it being kind of a theoretical kind of thing.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I feel like you have so many storylines that we could go flying down. And because I want to jump to, and you've mentioned you've got young kids, and I wanted to talk to you about parenthood, but I feel like we're about to jump forward from probably a whole bunch of stuff that has happened in between there.
That's okay.
But let's go forward to, so you've become a mother. And how, and especially now with the context of your story of running away from home, how has becoming a mother shaped your perception of career building and your career going forward?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think before I became a mum, you know, like that period when I knew I was going to get pregnant and then when I got pregnant, and that was the point at which I'd taken my first kind of HR leadership role. So, you know, I'd had various different HR and recruitment roles, but this was the first time that I was kind of owning that function, and I'd been doing that for a couple of years. And I was scared. Like, I was really fearful of what becoming a mother was going to mean for that. And I actually went and saw a career coach at that time. It was the first time I'd ever seen one. And I did like a 10-week program or something. And I found it really helped me to see that I could go and focus my time on being a parent for, you know, for that 12 months that I was, I'm allowed to separate those two things for a time. And it helped me to kind of let go and to really trust that that person that was going to sit in my role was going to do an amazing job. And I really appreciate the fact that I did that. I kind of went to the career coach wanting to get to figure out what was going to be my plan for the future without necessarily realizing that it was almost impossible to know what that was going to be until I'd really, you know, felt it and experienced it. So, but on the other hand, at the time, I remember before we got married, my husband had taken a year off work. You know, after working for 20 years, he's like, you know, I've got the, this is the space and time I've got to take that break before we have kids. He said it was the best thing that he ever did. And he still says that. And in many ways, it was actually really amazing to have that 12 months of parental leave as some time and space. I mean, it wasn't that much time and space, but mainly like at night when you're breastfeeding and you're just thinking to kind of reflect on my career and think about what that means for me. And I think the biggest shift of becoming a mum or a parent on your career is just that you suddenly have a different emphasis on what's important. And so I think the meaning part of my work became much more important because, you know, I had this limited amount of time now to do work. So it was like, and if whatever time I spend at work is time I'm not with my kids, not that I necessarily wanted to be with them all the time, but so, but that, that time that I was working kind of needed to be a little bit more meaningful. And so I think that was probably the biggest shift in how I viewed it. But also one of the things when I was thinking about this question earlier is becoming a parent also, the identity part of it is huge because suddenly you are a parent and you everything you do is for somebody else. You're not working. And I think a lot of our identity is, well, you're not working in a paid way. And a lot of our identity is caught up in work. And so I felt like I had a bit of a crisis of identity at that time. And for me, the vision of work at the end of that 12 months was like kind of a bit of an anchor that I could attach myself to, oh, I can go back and be that Bex again. You know, I don't know, this Bex is just swimming in nappies and milk and, you know, crying babies. But I can go and be work Bex again. And I kind of like looked forward to that as well. And it kind of, as an opportunity to kind of shape my identity again. So I think those were the sort of biggest shifts in the way that I viewed work. Especially with that first bub.
It's a real swirl of or like almost conflicting emotions, really, of like on the one hand it's like, oh, I could go back and be that person again. On the other hand, it's like, oh, work has way less meaning for me now because something has superseded it. And you're sort of, that's all then swirling around while you're sitting up at the middle of the night breastfeeding. So that was good. I was about to say, when you said that, what would be if for someone in that, that scenario, what's some good things that they could sort of be thinking on in the moments, the either the mundane or the very hard, that sort of helps steer their mind towards maybe more positive thoughts if they're sort of in the midst of all of those conflicting feelings that you mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's, you know, it's really important that at the, that point in time, you can't, you don't, like I said before, you don't need to think about the rest of your career. It doesn't need to be, you don't need to be planning 20 years down the track. And that, you know, you just, it's just one step back into the world of work. And it's okay to figure that out as you go along as well. Like, you don't need to be putting a lot of pressure on yourself to be work Bex again. Like, I felt at the time, because that person is not the same. It's not the same person anymore. And you kind of can't figure out who that person is really until you sort of back into it as well. You know, like it's that first year of a baby is just, you know, so intense. But I think when I reflect on it, I actually put a real positive spin on it, because it was this, like, this forced break and forced space that I was able to take, that it kind of really helped my, what's the word I'm trying to say? Like risk, how I felt about taking a risk.
Risk aversion.
So it I felt like, oh, well, here's, I can take it. I can probably take a bit of a risk now, you know, and I could try something different. And this is the right time when maybe I've got, you know, I realized that I was privileged to have some government pay and to, you know, have a partner that was working where I had a little bit of security within which to take a risk. And I don't think I realized that as much with the first baby, but when I went back to, like, I went back to my leadership role 3 days a week after my parental leave, and didn't love it. My mojo had kind of gone a little bit. It was basically a full-time role in 3 days. I just wasn't interested in having that kind of pressure anymore. So I ended up taking a part-time recruiting role, which I was like, I can do that with my eyes closed. And then COVID hit, and then that went down to like 1 day a week, and that was fine with me because I was pregnant again. So by the time I got pregnant the second time, I was kind of able to look back and think, well, I've learned all that stuff that I need to know about how to raise a baby, which is really hard to learn the first time around. I've suddenly got this runway again, you know, this 12 months of thinking, well, I could do something with that now. Brenna, I've got a little bit more time. And so that's when I decided to do some part-time study and study careers. And, you know, it was, it gave me just that little bit of runway to try something new and different.
Yeah, awesome. And so that leads into your sort of coaching that you're doing now and stuff. And so what would you say are some of the barriers that when you're working with your clients, which you sort of had mentioned have is quite a few mums and stuff, how do you sort of approach coaching them, and what are some of the barriers that they're maybe trying to typically work through that that you support them with?
I think I like working with them because I see so much of my own struggle in them. And I think, first of all, a lot of it goes down, comes back to that traditional model of career, that I think, you know, a lot of people that I work with who are in those mid-career transitions, they are sort of millennials or older, millennials or whatever's before that, where they are caught up in that way of thinking that I need to have a really clear direction. It's going to be in an upwards trajectory, and I need to have that planned out step by step. And so I think just overcoming that barrier and giving them a different way of thinking around careers, that they are more squiggly, that you can experiment with things. And how can you know if you like something until you try it, and, you know, getting out of your head and taking some action. So I think that's the one big thing, is just giving them a different way of viewing their career and how important that is for the future of work, you know, because those linear career pathways just don't really exist in the same way that they used to. But confidence is a really big thing. I think there's, you know, just that self-confidence to present themselves, see themselves as someone who can add value, that even though having time out of the workforce, you know, that doesn't make you any less valuable. In fact, it gives you lots of skills that you can add. And helping them, so much of what I do is just reframing, you know, catching those negative thoughts and helping people to reframe them as something positive, and giving them some insight into people who've done it before, workplaces that are really supportive, so that there's that hope that they can see, oh no, I can do this. Somebody else has already done this. This workplace is telling me that they think my parenting skills and what I did before is valuable. Okay, I can do this. So it's that kind of, those blockers very much.
Can you give an example of a reframing conversation that you might have with someone?
I mean, I'm always just going to go back to the last one, yeah. You know, the most fresh one in your memory. So I'm helping someone at the moment, and we're kind of at the beginning of that coaching journey. But she has kids that are at primary school. She has been in the same kind of career pathway for the last 20 years. She kind of left that workplace because she didn't love it, and there were other things that were going on there. And she feels like she's also neurodiverse, and really was seeing a lot of her, the way in which she worked, as not being valuable, and feeling like she couldn't map that to other career pathways. And so I got her, asked her to, you know, share a lot of different examples with me, and we've had three sessions together, and I was really able to see in the way that she spoke about things, the way that she talked about going down rabbit holes and deep diving on problems and coming up with solutions and, you know, getting hyper-focused on things. She saw that as a negative, and I was able to say, I actually think you're a natural-born designer. Like, I think the way that you approach problems, the way you think about them, the way that your first question is, no, I need to learn more about the problem rather than the solution. I said, you're a designer. You just don't realize it, and you don't have the language to put around it. And all of these things that you're saying that you think are negative, I was able to give her examples around when deep diving is a great thing, when hyper-focusing is a great thing, when, you know, all of these examples of how she's add value, you know, to these different groups of people that she's worked with, just by asking things like, well, what did they say to you at the time? What feedback did they give you? You know, how did that change their lives? Or reframing it in that way. And then literally yesterday or the day before, I shared with her a webinar from the Stanford Design School about design thinking. And I'm getting all these messages. She's like, I'm 20 minutes in, and oh my God, you're so right. This is me. I'm like, yeah. So that's sort of one of the better, best conversations that I've had recently. But yeah, it's just sometimes it's just sort of saying, okay, well, I hear you saying this. So what you're telling me is that actually in this situation, you did this and it added a lot of value. And people are like, okay, well, when you put it that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's really good. I because I often tend to frame things around value. So I'll talk to people like, okay, yeah, well, that's the thing that you do. But it's like the deeper you can get down to the core values that drive that, the more expansive that can then go in so many different directions when you boil down, okay, yeah, graphic design, great. But what's underneath that? Okay, underneath that is curiosity. And underneath curiosity is a deep desire to have impact and, you know, and all these things and creativity and this sort of stuff. And then, oh, well, you can apply creativity to anything you want. You know? That's really good. So
I love that approach too. And I find what I find with a lot of the parents in that space where they are kind of early kids and trying to escape, that was a Freudian slip. But when they're trying to figure out that next thing, I really love the, and I'm thinking about design thinking. That's why I thought of that example. I love the designing your life approach, which is that kind of approach grounded in design thinking, because I think, often that bit about values can come later in the conversation, because I often work with these people who are really time poor. They feel scattered because they've got so many different focuses, and to give them lots and lots and lots of options feels overwhelming and kind of puts them in a position where they feel even more scared and nervous and drowning in kind of ideas. And so I love the designing your life approach in those situations where it's like, okay, just pick three. So like pick graphic design, pick whatever. And then cool. How are you going to prototype that? Awesome. So next week you're going to create three designs in Canva for something. And then we're going to come back and we're going to talk about, did you like that? How much time did you spend on it? You know, when you were doing it, how did you feel? Were you engaged? Were you energized? Yes, no. Okay, well, let's try out the next option. And it's like a real practical way. And then through doing that, then it's almost that next bit is kind of then going deeper and being like, ah, okay, well, here's where those values sit, but you weren't able to really figure those out until you did all the things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome. So heaps of people to unpack in that. Going to the other side of the coin, which is workplaces and employers, how do you see things either changing or where things still need to change by way of accommodation for people with, and obviously mothers is one, but there's all kinds of different life things and the way society values things these days that workplaces in many places are sort of struggling to adapt to. How do you sort of see that space unfolding?
It's such a wicked problem, isn't it? Like it's a multifaceted challenge. And I think workplaces do have a responsibility to, you know, create environments that are free of bias and do, you know, kind of create opportunities for flexible work for everyone. Because I think, you know, for women in the workplace and the challenges of having kids and coming back to work, a lot of that is also created because of the opportunities that the other partner doesn't have. So it is a challenging problem. I think it was also really illustrated, and I think there's been so much more conversation about it since the gender pay gap data was released. Yeah. And what I found really interesting about that data was being able to think about it from a careers point of view, you know, and tracking it all the way back to the start so that, yes, we've got this 19% pay gap that exists, but that's not about, you know, pay equity. Like, it's not about paying this men and women the same amount for doing the same role. It's about that broader spread of where men and women sit across, you know, different industries and roles. But also, and it's how some professions are, you know, very female dominated, and that a lot of those professions do tend to be less remunerated in our society. And so, you know, when you track that all the way back, it comes back to those stereotypes around that females are often in those caring, helping kind of roles, and that young boys who maybe don't feel that they can be that. And then, you know, kind of vice versa, that the young boys are, you know, are attracted to those roles that are, you know, maybe, you know, science or engineering or smashing stuff. And that girls don't think they can do that. And I think we're doing a better role of giving girls more opportunities to be those things, but maybe not vice versa for the boys to be in the caring roles, and how that creates sort of systemic challenges that suddenly we're talking to workplaces about how they're going to fix their gender pay gap. But the problem is so much deeper. Than that. So,
and self-feeding in many ways, because so I think about this, like, and so you talk there about, okay, the wage gap might be more related to life roles and stuff, and so, and I've often had the thought, like me and my wife don't have kids, but I'm like, oh, obviously they have dad, but she wants to be a mother that, you know, steps away from work at least for a period. But then all of a sudden you got the questions around like income, and it's like, so currently I am on slightly more than her. So then it's like, it kind of fuels it to go, oh, well, it's more affordable for us, for me to stay at work if that is the direction we went. And then it keeps fueling the thing, you know, like of going, like, if someone is going to step away from work, then you're losing a whole income. And so you need to try and keep as much as you can so that you can actually keep the baby alive.
And then it takes longer for that primary carer to kind of catch up in terms of, so then they're always the primary carer, which isn't, you know, I hate that language anyway, but it becomes really complicated. I mean, my situation is my husband's 8 years older than me, so his career was like super established when I was just starting to kick goals, and so it was sort of like a no-brainer. It was, if you treated it as a purely financial decision, that I was going to be the primary carer. And I think there are so many, we've gone away a little bit from the question, but I think there's so many things systemically in our society that we say we want to change things, but, you know, there are big things that have to shift. You know, even just things like the cost of childcare or school hours, like, you know, all of these things require someone, you know, kind of influence those choices around somebody staying at home. And if that the female in that or whoever in that partnership earns less because either they've chosen a less remunerated profession or because they're at a different point in their career to their partner, then it's, yeah, they're always going to kind of take that role because they don't have the opportunity. You know, I think the way out of that is where we do have, and this is kind of getting back to workplaces, if there are more opportunities around flexibility, if there are better kind of paid leave options for both parents to be able to take time off, to be able to, for both parents to work part-time for a period, and that's not going to be financially impactful because maybe the cost of childcare is cheaper, you know, and that starts to make more financial sense as well as social sense, you know. And I remember even at the time, you know, in a fit of rage, and was like, I remember saying to my husband, but if you, and this was 6 years ago, so things have even changed in that time, but I was like, well, why can't you go and ask to work 4 days instead of five? And then I could go back, and, you know, there was a perception that would be detrimental to his career at his workplace at that point in time. I don't think so as much now, but so there's lots of kind of factors at play.
Yeah, it's a really big one. And you're right, it gets the whole systems element and really deeply ingrained cultural things at play that aren't necessarily as easy to shift because there's so many different factors as to why they exist and they're not all blanketly wrong. It's, messy.
Yeah, very messy. And I think you don't see them, you know, before it happens, before you're impacted by it, you don't see it coming in the same way, or you think, well, that's not that big a problem, or you just, and this is why I love, so someone who is amazing, Ali Kilali, she started a business called Work Pants, and I met her through the Career Development Association. And what she's doing is working with organizations to get them to have career counseling in place for expecting parents, both parents, where, you know, if they were in the same workplace, but for primary and secondary carers, to have a career counseling session before they go off work. Mm. So when they're pregnant or when they're expecting, a career counseling session, you know, at a minimum one while they're off work, and then another career counseling session when they're back.
Yeah.
So that suddenly there's an opportunity to start these conversations and to provide that opportunity to consider all of these impacts and how these decisions are going to play into, you know, what comes next. And that, you know, what you think before having the baby might change while you're on leave, and then it might, you know, change again when you come back. And I think it's really a great idea to embed that more in workplaces.
Yeah, embedding it so that it feels less foreign for businesses, I think, because it's a big risk for a business to have to suddenly rethink how they do business, right? Especially for small employers and things like that. They're just trying to keep their head above water, and they're not necessarily trying to solve the issues of gender inequality and all of this. But wherever you can demystify it to sort of say, hey, well, here's a way that you can embed flexibility and embed different ways for parents to work together to be able to raise their children and care for them in the way that they desire, in a way that makes sense and can sort of be built into your business. So I think the more of that, the better. Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. This has been really good. We could go on forever. But if people wanted to follow you, find out more about you, Rebecca, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So my business is called Design Your Best Work Life. So you can find me at Design Your Best Work Life on Instagram and Facebook, or my website is designyourbestworklife.com. I almost said www. Oh my gosh, that's like a millennial thing.
That is awesome. Millennials, we're coming old now. I know.
It definitely was a sign of my age.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Rebecca.
Thank you for having me, Alex.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. And let's connect on LinkedIn so that we can keep the conversation going. Or head to my website and download my free resource, The Career Building Principles. Bye for now.